The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
So I'm delighted to join to the Culture Club this evening. Willie White is with us, who is the Festival Director for the Dublin Theatre Festival, launching this evening. Willie, thank you very much for being with us. So tell us, how many productions will people be able to enjoy and over what dates?
35 productions, Matt. The festival starts on the 26th of September and runs until the 13th of October, with some productions in the Gate, the Abbey and elsewhere running on beyond that.
Okay, and tell us a little bit, how many people would go to the Dublin Theatre Festival in a good year?
We're actually aiming to double our audience, more or less, because we were still recovering from COVID last year. So tens of thousands of people. I mean, some of the tickets we sell, others are sold by the Abbey, the Gate and the suburban venues around town, but it's all Dublin Theatre Festival.
And who's it for?
It's for the people of Dublin, and we try to attract as many of them as possible. We try to have a programme that appeals to different types of people. Obviously, you've got the seasoned theatre goers who've been going, in some cases, for more than 60 years. But we very much have our eye on younger people and new people to the theatre. You may be aware there was research published last year by the Arts Council which said there's been a real falling off in the 18 to 24 cohort. A lot of it to do with COVID. And we very much have them in mind, so there are at least some...
How do you get them back? I mean, does it have to be usually through college or whatever?
The tricky thing is college is not really back in term by the time that we start, so we've got to get them otherwise. Usually it's through social media and also through attractive pricing. So we introduced an incentive 2 years ago called 10 for 10, which means we put on 10% of our tickets on sale for €10, and it could be a ticket that otherwise would cost €45, to people who are under 30 who are arts workers or artists. And it's been phenomenally successful. I was talking to my colleague earlier on today. We opened subscriptions yesterday and already we have more than 200.
Very good. But tell us a little bit more about how, what sort of plays do you stage to attract younger people in, and how concerned would you be about the tradition, the Irish tradition of going to stage shows disappearing?
I mean, I think if you're a young person and if you encounter the tradition, I saw the book on the, at home today, our son is studying it, of Sive. No shade against John B. Keane, he's a great playwright, but I'm trying to imagine like what a 17-year-old would be able to understand about a play that originated in the 1960s in a very different Ireland. So
I enjoyed the updated version of
good,
it. Good,
good, good to hear, and I heard it was a very good production. But I suppose I feel that a lot of young people encounter theatre through their school curriculum, and a lot of the time it's on the curriculum because it's examinable, but not necessarily relevant to their concerns and the experience that they have to that stage of their life. So I suppose I wouldn't start with Sive. I'd start with something that's closer to their concerns, and hopefully that they'd make their way to Sive or Tom Murphy or William Shakespeare or whomever. So I think you have to kind of, you have to talk to them about the things that they're interested in or that they understand. I mean, if I think about, and we'll talk about music now, if I think about the first time that I listened to something like Van Morrison's Astral Weeks, I was 18. Sure, I had no life experience to bring to that. And then when you go back to it again and again, you kind of go, oh yeah, I get it. I get feeling like this. I guess, you know, having these kinds of thoughts. So that's what we do. But also, there's one particular performance that I have in mind that I hope will attract, as well as an established audience, a diverse and a young and a new audience, which is a piece by a UK artist called Benji Reid called Find Your Eyes. He is a hip-hop artist, a photographer, a theatre maker. He uses movement and he makes this beautiful visual performance along with personal storytelling that we're going to present for four performances in the O'Reilly Theatre the last week of the festival. This was opened in Manchester Festival, a very exciting festival that happens every 2 years in Manchester, that a lot of the time mixes kind of established genres with kind of, you know, architecture or rock and roll or visual art, and mixes it all up and generally has a very kind of contemporary and popular but high quality program. 5 stars in the Guardian newspaper, and I'm hoping that people will receive it in the same way here.
So you must go and travel and watch an awful lot to decide as to what you want, do you?
I do. I mean, I try to travel selectively, obviously, for thinking about the climate, but yeah, there's no substitute for sitting down in a room and watching a show and imagining how it might be for your audience at home. And of course, while videos are kind of useful, they're 2D things. So you have no sense of what the scenography or what the three-dimensional picture are, or actually how the audience beside you are feeling. So yeah, I do. I go and see shows, but I like it still.
We'll get to theatre in a little while, but I want to start, as we always do on the Culture Club, with musical choices. And you're the third person in about 6 weeks who has picked Adamant as your first single. However, it isn't Stand and Deliver that you've gone for.
I remember Stand and Deliver. I remember that video. And I remember we used to put, if anybody knows what Adamant looks like, it's probably would be considered cultural appropriation these days. But he used to wear certainly in one of his persona, he used to wear a white stripe across his face, which we replicated down in Abbey Leaks using pseudocreme. So I remember Stand and Deliver and Prince Charming, which was on, my parents bought me the album on tape up in Dublin one time, and I think that they the lyric sheet mysteriously disappeared. So there were these kind of confusing and spicy words that I couldn't quite understand. But when I had the wherewithal to buy a single myself, I think I bought it on a school tour to Galway. Maybe we were going to Leisureland, and I bought it. It was kind of disappointing. It was actually, when I was looking back on this, it's a solo single. It's not with the Ants. It's his third solo single. But yeah, Goody Two Shoes wasn't as good as the other stuff. But that, I suppose, it reflects my age. I was born in 1970.
So this is Adamant rather than Adamant.
Yeah, it
Adamant
is Adamant, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's hear it. Wasn't what Paul McLoone said. Originally, Adamant was a punk. And then I think he transitioned almost not quite new romantic, but he went towards that. But that just sounds like straightforward pop music.
It is pop music, yeah, yeah. And actually, I've hardly listened to it since the early 1980s. I just reviewed it before doing this.
Okay, you've got loads of favourite albums to offer us. In particular, the one that we're going to take a clip from is C-Mat and the album Crazy Mad For Me. Tell us about why you picked
it. C-Mat, Ciara Marie Alice Thompson from Dunboyne, County Meath, is probably a 27 or 20-year-old, 28-year-old country pop star who is phenomenon. They joke in the office about me standing C-Mat. I just like her songs. And I came, actually, it was the Pillow Queens who I was introduced to C-Mat via in social media or something like that, because I was a big fan of theirs at the time too. This is her second album. She's a fantastic songwriter. She recorded this in Bergen with some hotshot producer. Saw her in Fairview Park, maybe for the third or fourth time recently. She was absolutely amazing. I was with my 12-year-old daughter. My wife is way back behind the barrier. She's not so interested in going close to the front. And my daughter was slagging me for getting emotional. It's just great music. I went to my first concert in 1985, but I still like music and I still like new music. And check it out. You know, some people stay with what they knew as a teenager, but I still check out new music every week.
Well, the track we're going to play from the Crazy Mad For Me album features John Grant as well. This is Where Are Your Kids Tonight? Album as good as that track?
Bangers, full of wall-to-wall bangers. That wouldn't be it's a brilliant, actually. John Grant joined C-Mat on stage in Fairview Park and was brilliant. A high point, along with her cover of Kate Bush. Apparently C-Mat's parents are from Waterford, as is Kate Bush's
parents. Yeah, okay. In the notes and the questionnaire that we give to all of our Culture Club guests, you say, I wish I could listen to the Pixies' Surferosa for the first time again. Why'd you say that?
It's just, and in fact, actually, I listen back and I think maybe I feel this. Feel it's more like Doolittle than Surferosa. But when you just listen to that music that's become so iconic And it, the first time, it's just, it was like nothing I'd heard before. I mean, it's not very complicated music. It's very spare and well recorded and eccentric. But the first time you listen to it, first, certainly I think I was walking out of UCD. I borrowed the tape from somebody walking out towards Roebuck Road or wherever. And on the, and that's the thing as well. Like a lot of the music that I would have listened through throughout my life has been on headphones, not on, on vinyl. At home, we had a record player that my mum used to put arrangements of Flowers on. I used to have to take the daffodils off and lift the lid and put on whatever I bought in Portlaoise. But then once I got, you know, a personal stereo of some sort, I think it was an Akai, you would listen to stuff on tape and borrow tapes from other people. And I just remember listening to that. It was in UCD Dramsuck, I think, at the time. I didn't hear it immediately. It went out. And there was another EP, Come On Pilgrim, that used to be harder to get your hands on. But I just remember listening to it, and just as the sound of the drums, I think, is the first track, Bum Machine, maybe. And it just sounded fantastic and scary and exciting. And particularly when you're listening to something at that age, you want to identify with a kind of music that you think defines you or the things you aspire to. It was fantastic.
But you also have a love of jazz, is it? John Coltrane and Miles Davies, the two you've mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, when you start getting into music, or when you read interviews with musicians you admire, you hear them talking about other musicians. You go, well, what does that sound like? You become more curious. And again, if you've grown up in a diet of listening to pop music or rock music, that's not that complicated, you know, kind of musically. It'd be good, but it's not that complicated musically. And then, you know, I mean, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, or Sketches of Spain are pretty kind of common classic albums. And then if you start getting a bit more adventurous and try something like Bitches Brew or John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, it doesn't sound like what you expect. You know, the tonalities, the chords, the phrasing is different. The instrumentation is usually not amplified, and you're just trying. And that's, I used to find it so exciting trying to understand and make sense of that kind of music that you would have felt when you're listening to it first. It's kind of hard. When I was listening back to, John Coltrane before this, I thought, oh no, this is, I get it now. I feel it, you know. It's very soulful music. It still has the kind of the blues structure in there somewhere, but it's much more adventurous. And, jazz is black classical music for the 20th century. It's up there with the canon of Western classical music. It's extremely sophisticated music.
And then you have one other choice, which is a very personal one, Stevie Wonder's Talking Book.
Yeah, Stevie Wonder and I shared the same birthday, the 13th of May, though in different years. And when we had our first child, Oscar, who's now nearly 20, we had Oscar in Hollis Street. And I suppose at the time of CDs, you're invited. I mean, this is obviously, my wife was busy with having the baby, but I was thinking about what we were invited by the midwives, because we had the baby in the community midwife scheme, to bring in some CDs to listen to for as long as labour took. And there was a selection. I think Neil Young's Harvest was in there as well. A jazz album by Esbjørn Svensson. And then Stevie Wonder's Talking Book. And certainly the album was playing. I don't know if it was the exact track, but I'd like to think it was You Are the Sunshine of My Life when Oscar was born. And of course, he is the sunshine of our lives.
Favourite band? You have nominated Lancôme.
Again, I wouldn't want to nail my colours to the mast, because it depends when you ask me. If I was 15, I'd say something. But I've seen Lancôme quite a few times. They won Album of the Year. They've won the Choice Music Prize. They're absolutely brilliant and interesting musicians. I think I saw them first live in at Other Voices in St. James's Church. And then I've seen them in Vicar Street a bunch of times. I saw them playing a benefit at the Three Arena, which is a pretty big gig, and they totally nailed it, as did the others in the bill. And then most recently in the Royal Hospital, Kilmainham. And they're just, they're phenomenal. There is something cosmic that happens. And unlike a lot of traditional bands, they operate around the bass frequencies. You know, they're shades of drone metal. Their engineer, John Spud Murphy, is a very important part of their sound. And he's in another band called Oxen with Rady Pete, Katie Kamen, Eleanor Myler. And there's just something about, like, I've rarely been at a gig where somebody cheers an Illan Pipe solo, and that solo is a drone, it's a low drone. And they're musicians, and they tend to play long, mesmeric, meditative songs. And actually are, you know, increasingly great songwriters themselves. So they sound fantastic, and they have a cult. I mean, the fact that they could headline a gig in the Royal Hospital Kilmainham, that certainly says something about them. They're hugely popular. Got into a bit of trouble in Germany because of some statements that they made, but they're hugely popular in the UK and around the world.
Well, what we have, I'm not sure what concert in Dublin this is from, but this is Rocky Road to Dublin.
Boys of Liverpool, when we safely landed, called myself a fool. I could no longer stand it, blood began to boil. Temper I was losing, poor old Aaron's oil. They began abusing a rammy salt, says I. Shillelagh, I let fly. Galway boys were boy, and saw I was a hobbling with the loud array. Giant in the affray, we quickly cleared away for the rocky road to Dublin. One, two, three, four, five. Hunt the hare
see what you mean about the low.
Yeah, I mean that's a milder version of it. But you can hear the drone in the background there, exactly. And Ready Pete taking the solo on her concertina. I think that was one of the concerts in Vickers. There's a live album that's out recently. I think I might have been at that one. There was a series, but I think I might have been at one of the recordings of it.
You obviously go to a lot of gigs.
As much as possible. I really enjoy live music, you know. It was a killer during the pandemic when you couldn't go to live anything. And I, because I'm tall, I can, you know, I obviously try not to stand in anybody's way, but I can cope with pretty raucous gigs. Actually, if you look at my Twitter profile, there's a picture that I didn't take of the lead singer, Carla Chubb from Sprint, standing on my shoulders as she went to dive into the crowd there at a gig in the Button Factory in May.
Which is one of the two best recent gigs you've nominated. Yeah. That and CMAT at Fairview
Park.
Yeah,
I saw Sprint in Berlin in February as well when I was overdoing something else, and she crowd surfed with me. She doesn't know who I am and I'm not stalking her. But they're great. They're great. They're a young kind of Irish post-punk band, and they play a fantastic live gig and they write good songs.
But you go back to the first best gig, U2 Croke Park 1985, when you were only a young fella.
It was the 29th of June 1985. I was 15 years old. I remember the colour of the ticket, it was yellow. I think was it £12.50 or something like that. I went with my friend Owen Gallagher and stayed with his granny in Clontarf. His sister went as well, maybe to chaperone us. They were touring the Unforgettable Fire at that time. I'd never been to any kind of concert, let alone an arena concert in Croke Park. People were mad out of it. I was a little bit intimidated. We were in the stands, so we were grand. And it was...
Of course, that's the old Croke Park as well.
Yeah,
the old Croke Park.
Yeah, the old Croke Park. And it was a pretty good lineup. I mean, I didn't know the music so well, but it was obviously REM before they really broke through into Anua, who were a local band on the up at the time. The Squeeze, obviously from the 70s and onwards. And The Alarm, kind of a Welsh punk band who appears with U2. But I most remember U2. And then Michael Stipe, as far as I recall, was wearing a raincoat. And it was a time when you could bring drink into gigs and people were throwing, as far as I recall, flagons full of wee at Michael Stipe, so which he had to dodge. Well, I think it might have been raining as well during their gig. Or drizzling.
As long as he hoped it was just rain.
Yeah, no, it was brilliant. I saw them again in 1987 in Croke Park and also in Porky Cove.
You too?
Yeah. And then I didn't see them for a long, long time. And I went to see them one more time and I was kind of disappointed. And then I went back again when they were in the Three Arena. They were absolutely fine. I got very emotional. and so it's just the first band you like and, you know, you get to understand. And again, listen to on headphones, listen to Boy, October War. Got some of the early singles in repressings on 7-inch. I have some of them at home still. And there's actually a brilliant, there's a bootleg, because, you know, I'm from the era when people used to sell tapes in O'Connell Bridge, but there's a bootleg you can find on YouTube of U2 playing the National Stadium in 1980, just before Boy came out, I think. I think Bono might have only been 19 in it. I think Boy maybe came out in September. And it's amazing to see a band on the cusp of something and their demeanour with the crowd and lots of songs that are not yet fully formed and others that are discarded or ended up in B-sides. And the next thing you know, it's Boy and the rest is history.
Well, actually, the track we're going to play, it isn't from Dublin, but it's back from live from the Red Rocks Amphitheatre in Colorado in 1983, I Will Follow. U2, I Will Follow. Before we get to theatre, movies. And what sort of things do you look for in a movie?
I suppose I like movies that are visually interesting. I don't really like blockbusters. I went to see Twister at the weekend. No offence to the millions of people who earn billions for the producers. That's not my kind of thing. Saw Civil Wars as well recently. Actually, the movie I saw that I enjoyed most recently, and I will call it boring as a compliment, is That They May Face the Rising Sun. I thought it was a wonderful movie about the rhythms of country life, a little bit before my time, but before I was kind of mature. But it was so uneventful and deep. I thought it was a really brave movie to make. I loved Colin Kuhn. I love Song of Granite as well. I don't only like Irish movies, but I like movies that are usually quite visually strong, sometimes not with a lot of talking. I'm a talkative person myself, but I like when people tell stories with pictures as opposed to lots of dialogue.
You gave us a list of some of the classics like Citizen Kane and Singing in the Rain and Breathless and 8 and a Half. But then you gave us things as well like Morvern Caller. Tell us about that.
Morvern Caller is based in a book by the Scottish author Alan Warner. It's made by Lynn Ramsey. She comes from a visual art background, photography background. It tells the story of Samantha Morton's character. We are introduced to find her boyfriend has died in their flat. She's a very taciturn person. They live in Scotland in a kind of a deprived community. And anyway, she finds a manuscript on his PC and she passes it off as her own and heads off to Spain. She's followed there by the agents who think this is brilliant. They want to give her loads of money. And has she got anything else coming? And she spoofs her way through it along with her sidekick. But there's some amazing, beautifully told and mysterious film from the point of view of pictures. There's the kind of the student or the Spanish resort party from hell that's going on in an apartment complex where people are shouting in the kind of the concourse and toilet rolls are flying at the window. And nobody knows what's going on and it's terrifying and mysterious. And yeah, it's great. So and she's made quite a few films. So
let's get a clip from it because this is where Morvern, played by Samantha Morton, meets her friend Lana in work and is still pretending that her boyfriend has moved abroad.
Merry Christmas, Pip.
Oh, Lana, didn't get you anything. Sorry.
I don't mind that, it's not a big deal.
Come here.
Don't worry, he'll come back.
Lana, film staff to bakery section.
I'll meet you at Nancy's at 9, right?
Can Lana, film staff please make her way to bakery section?
Okay.
And you can hear Nancy and Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood in the background there because the soundtrack is brilliant. There's Canon, it's Stereo Lab and lots of others. And the kind of the fusion of image and music that Lynn Ramsey achieves is fantastic.
Other choices you have is Fish Tank.
Fish Tank, another depressing filmmaker, perhaps. Andrea Arnold, this is a film with Michael Fassbender and there's a tricky relationship with a young woman in it. Dancing, again, lots of strong movie. Andrea Arnold, before that had made Wasp, which was, I think, an Oscar-winning short. And I think I was introduced to her work by two other films, Ratcatcher and Red Road. Hope I'm not mixing colour up. Yeah, so again, you know, just slightly lugubrious, visually poetic, well-paced, meditative films with good music into it.
Okay.
But then other times when people say, what's your favourite movie? I say Coming to America, and I mean it.
That's the Eddie Murphy one.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Okay, right. Okay, the impossible one to ask your favourite play or musical or whatever, because your choices probably shift all the time. But just give us a couple of ones that stand out for you.
Yeah, I mean, if I think about the first time my mind was genuinely blown, I was in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival and I met a friend of mine. It's actually Jim Culleton. I went to see a show by Jim Culleton, met somebody else I knew. And they said, are you going to see a show by Pina Bausch? And I said, never heard of him. And at the time, you could get cheap tickets, like our 10 for 10 tickets, for a fiver. And the Edinburgh Playhouse was a huge venue, more than 2,000 seats. So I toddled along. It was free. And the place was fairly empty. I sat in a better seat. And I had no idea what to expect. And I had an open mind, which is very important. It's easy to have an open mind when it only costs you £5. And I couldn't believe what I was... I really couldn't believe. I didn't have no idea that you could do this in a theatre. I mean,
Do what?
Well, it was men in dresses, a station full of carnations, people jumping off scaffolding towers onto loads of cardboard boxes, Alsatians on stage, people miming The Man I Love. Is that Billie Holiday? As a spectacle, as what, and then also kind of performers addressing the
audience. What was the name of this?
It's a famous piece called Nelken, which is the German word for carnations, by the German choreographer Pina Bausch, who died in 2009, same year as Michael Jackson. it's been revived recently in places like Sadler's Wells in London. She's a huge, huge figure of post-war contemporary performance and dance, very, very influential. Her Café Müller and A Rite of Spring are iconic works, along with this one. And I managed to see, I became a bit of a fanboy and I managed to see reasonable amount of pieces in subsequent years in London and in Paris, maybe. Yeah, and you know, that was the thing I did. My girlfriend then, we went on pilgrimages to Paris and other cities to see performers we might have seen in Dublin Theatre Festival or might have seen in Edinburgh because we both worked there at the time.
the pick that you've made from the Dublin Theatre Festival is what opened the festival in 2019. Michael Keegan Dolan's Mam. Tell us
Mom,
about
Mom, sorry. It's an Irish word meaning an Oscar. The experience, so Michael is based, Michael's from Dublin, from Clontarf, but he's based currently down in Kirkaguina with his partner Rachel Poirier and their children. Rachel also performs in the work. And this is a piece that I saw, you know, run through in Holland Fionnuala down in Kirkaguina shortly before it came to Dublin, so I knew what it contained broadly. It's also the subject matter for the film that was made about it, The Dance, although that goes all the way up to the point before it is performed. And I was sitting in the O'Reilly Theatre in my seat knowing what to expect. It also kind of relates back to, it uses a tune called Mark Lua Inail, which is on a Sean Arido album that I listened to in the car with my dad as a kid, and the tunes still stay with me. So you have Cormac Begley on stage playing his concertina, cast of international dancers, including Michael and Rachel's daughter, and contemporary musicians, and just the inhalation of breath into the bellows of the concertina and the music that starts off and the picture that on stage that the performers create in, I don't know, was it 80 minutes of dance, was unbelievably moving. I felt like I was floating up, like in Fellini's 8.5, I felt like I was floating above the performance. It was so amazing. And the show has had huge success. It was in Venice last year, and before going, it played two performances in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre to probably about 3,000 people, which is the most people who've ever seen a work of contemporary dance by an Irish artist.
Let's hear a little bit from it.
Brings us back to the days of dancing on the radio, eh?
Absolutely.
But you'll have to imagine the rest. No, it's fantastic. And actually, when we were kids, obviously, the people who chose the music you listened to were your parents. So when we were driving around in the car with my dad, he had Oria de Saggetti that was recorded in the Gaiety in the 1960s. And that tune reminds me of that album, as well as The March of the High Kings of Leash and Nguyenas and all those. So that's stayed with me for more than 50 years, along with The Muppet Show and Benny Goodman and Glen Campbell.
Your recall is extraordinary. You're up there with Philip King, who did the Culture Club.
Well, he'd want to be good at that, wouldn't he?
For remembering all these names and all these tracks and stuff. Books. You have a big interest in Irish fiction.
Yeah, I do. And I try, there's so much going on, and I like to be stimulated. And oftentimes you pick up books and you forget about them. You have to start them all over again. But yes, I do. And I think Irish fiction is extremely strong at the moment. The last book I read was Usha McKenna's Evenings and Weekends, Sinead Gleeson's Hagstone as well, I really enjoyed. Wild Houses I read in holidays in May. I read the new Colm Tobin in about 3 days. I was bereft when I finished it. I needed something else. So I bought Megan Nolan's Ordinary Human Failings, which I'm still trying to finish. But yeah, I mean, Irish fiction is really, really strong. And not only is the fiction strong, but the movie adaptations that it engenders, whether it be small things like these or the John McGahan adaptation in That They May Face the Rising Sun. It's actually a hard thing to do, to translate a novel onto the screen, but for some reason there's something cooking at the moment.
And you've also mentioned the likes of Paul Murray's The Bee Sting.
Oh yeah, I mean, I actually got The Bee Sting before it came out. I think it was launched in about June of last year, but it's an intimidating tome, and I was kind of busy, you know, for the latter part of the year, but I picked it up again in January and I read it at a pace and my heart was in my mouth when I read those last chapters. I had to put the book down and take a deep breath. It's fantastic writing. It reminds me as well of before that it's in the vein of another, I mean, I've read all of his books, but certainly it was up there with Skippy Dies for me as a kind of a really substantial piece of work. I've heard rumours it might be arriving on a screen sometime. I think it's eminently adaptable. I don't know if these rumours are true.
But you started it anyway.
I don't mean to be starting. Well, I suppose let me put it like this. I think if you look at the success of Normal People and Conversations with Friends, it might be that, yeah. You know.
Okay, yeah, I see. You also have Anne Enright's actress.
Sally
Rooney and Claire Keegan in this. I'm conscious of time,
sure
so
thing,
I need to move on. Television. You're like myself. You grew up in single channel land, did you?
I still remember watching Quick Draw McGraw in Hayes and Evolve Television before we got the RTE2 aerial. It would have been Quick Draw McGraw and El Cabongo in 1979. Yeah, I remember when the telly wasn't on first thing in the morning. You had to wait for it to come on. And I used to read the TV listings in the Irish Independent or the Irish Press or whatever we had at home and imagine what was on the other channels, but we only had one channel, yeah.
So the likes of The Man from Atlantis and Wanderley Wagon.
Yeah, Saturday mornings were big. Yeah.
And what about adult television?
Do you know, I mean, because I spend so much time going to the theatre or doing other things, being social, but I don't watch that much television. I don't watch terrestrial television very much at all. Usually what I watch is on a streaming service or on the player. And I find I'm that curmudgeonly that I did really get on board with The White Lotus and with Succession. They were really good. But then, like, I've been learning Portuguese, so I try and watch Brazilian series on Netflix as well. And then French, just because I find, like, if you're only consuming English language media, you only get a particular view of the world.
Portuguese, that's an unusual choice.
Well, I was in Sao Paulo in March 2020, having ignored people's advice about traveling, thinking this virus in the East was nothing. And I was there just before Leo Varadkar declared, you know, the emergency. So I haired it back. And before I'd been going, I met a Brazilian colleague who invited me. So I started learning Portuguese and Duolingo. What I found was Duolingo was no good. So one of my many lockdown projects, along with pickling and sourdough, and a more successful one, was actually learning Portuguese online. And what you find out, a load of Irish people with Portuguese boyfriends and girlfriends learned it online to speak to the in-laws.
Okay, we have to finish with the cultural buried treasure. You have nominated something. You're the second person to nominate it. Peter Lennon's documentary, The Rocky Road to Dublin. Why have you picked that?
You didn't pick Quacks or Fortune as a Cousin in the Bronx. It's a brilliant documentary, and I came across it a few years. It was made in 1967 by Jean-Luc Godard's cinematographer, Raoul Coutard. It was at the Cannes Film Festival in 68, but that was the year of the protest, so it kind of sank without a trace until it was revived more recently. And it's a fantastic photo essay of Dublin in a kind of a spiritual and moral torpitude in the years after the 50th anniversary of 1916. The question that goes through it is, what do you get with your revolution once you've done it? A lot of the personages of the day, like Conor Cruise O'Brien, Michael Cleary are in there, and lots of footage of Dublin at the time. It's brilliant. And O'Donoghue's Pub too.
Okay, give us 30 seconds on Quaxer's Fortune Has a Cousin in the Bronx.
You can find it on YouTube. Gene Wilder plays an Irish guy called Quaxer Fortune who collects horse manure around Dublin to try and sell to rich people to fertilise.
Gene Wilder,
a very unlikely guy to play an Irish
Margot
Kidder is the love interest, yeah. It's on YouTube. I don't know what the story is.
And is it good?
It's entertaining, but also it's brilliant because you can see what Dublin looked like back then.
Terrific stuff. Thank you so much, Willie White, director of the Dublin Theatre Festival, on from the 26th of September to the 13th of October. General sale from the 7th of August, but festival programme today, priority booking at dublintheatrefestival.ie. Thank you so much for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.